The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to keep on top of the latest news from China in just a few minutes a day with our free daily email newsletter, our handy smartphone app, and of course at our website, subchina.com. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I am in New York today, where I am joined by the man with the golden corn, Mr. Jin Yumi, also known as Jeremy Goldcorn. Please, greet our gentle listeners, Jeremy.
Hello, dear listeners. And Kaiser, when are you going to run out of these cheesy things?
I'm not going to. I have an inexhaustible supply. So today we are honored and delighted to have as our guest Stephen Roach, an economist who's been a keen and very canny observer of China's remarkable development for many years now. Stephen is senior fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs and a senior lecturer at Yale School of Management. He was formerly chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia and chief economist for Morgan Stanley. He's the author of the excellent book Unbalanced, The Codependency of America and China, which was published in 2014. It's a fantastic read, and we'll be talking about many the ideas and insights it offers, as well as giving a bit of an update and looking at how things have played out since it was published. Stephen Roach, welcome to Cynica.
Thank you, Kaiser. Great to be here with you and Jeremy.
Stephen, welcome. Let's jump right in and talk about Unbalanced. Your book is essentially an exploration of what you call the growth trap of codependency, in which, at least in this case, the ultimate consumer, the United States, meets the ultimate producer, China, and how they enable one another in ultimately unsustainable models of growth. In what ways does this differ from the Chimerica idea that the historian Niall Ferguson advanced?
Well, Chimerica, a view that Niall endorsed, but then like many of the things he endorsed, he took the other side of it as well. You know, it sort of talks about the seamless integration of two powers in the realm of economic engagement, and noting that they both played important roles in supporting an increasingly integrated global economy. And my view is that the relationship has long been a much more complex interaction. Both systems, both economies, both nations had clear needs in the late 1970s for new recipes for economic growth, and the ultimate consumer, the United States, really needed to figure out a new way to satisfy consumers who were increasingly strapped of income with cheap goods, and China, the ultimate producer, whose economy was in pretty desperate shape in the late 1970s, needed to figure out a new way to grow, and exporting to needy American consumers fit its recipe as well. And so there was a real need that brought them together, and that need then became addictive, hence the codependent diagnosis of the sort of amateur psychologist turned economist that made me want to write this book.
So you could think of it as the dark side or the pathological side of Chimerica then.
Well, codependency is an unhealthy relationship, and it's true of humans, and I think it's true of economies, because ultimately the partners in a codependent relationship lose their sense of self. Their identity gets tied up in the way that they end up satisfying the other, and it can be a pathology that feeds on itself, because again, the goods provided by the ultimate producer were exactly what the ultimate consumer needed, and the demand provided by the ultimate consumer was exactly, you know, the type of growth that the exporter, China, needed. So the growth solution that came out of this codependency became a very addictive aspect of this codependency.
You use the phrase false prosperity very frequently in your book. So what forms of false prosperity took hold in the U.S., in China, and in Europe? And what makes the prosperity apparently enjoyed in these different geographies actually false?
Well, it's my sense is, Kaiser, that it's a important outgrowth of the political economy of economic growth. There's enormous pressure on economic policymakers to deliver fast rates of economic growth. And when growth lags, as it does from time to time, or it has for a long time in many of the advanced economies of the developed world, the pressures intensify from the political spectrum to generate more growth. And the false prosperity comes about when policymakers take shortcuts, thinking that they can create a new and lasting surge of economic growth by making some changes in tax laws or approaches to asset markets, asset bubbles, new financial products, new innovations, believing that they can deliver growth by pulling the levers of markets and policies rather than really drawing on the indigenous sustenance of economic growth that we economists have always felt comes from improved productivity. And you name the country, they all tried it. The U.S., we thought we could do it, deliver more growth through asset bubbles. Europe thought they could do it by, you know, creating a very flawed currency union. Japan thought it could produce more growth by this mercantilist export-led policy. And those are shortcuts that ended up being dead ends for all of those developed economies.
In China's case, it was not only the mercantilist approach of Japan, but also this really investment-led kind of that results in overcapacity.
Well, I'm not exactly convinced that China has gone down the road of false prosperity. There is a risk that China could fall victim to that. But, I mean, you take the investment point that you just made. The view in the West is that, you know, China's got too much investment relative to the size of its economy. The investment share, depending on how you measure it, runs the 40 to 50% of GDP. It's unheard of compared with other modern economies. So, you know, the indictment goes that China has got its economy skewed far too much toward investment, and that's what drives the debt-intensive growth. It's gotten China trapped in a potentially Japanese-like quagmire. It's a great story, and it does resonate with some of the problems that we've seen from time to time in developed economies. But you got to just pause and say, wait a second. This is a poor, relatively undeveloped country that, coming out of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution in the late 1970s, basically didn't have much in the way of a productive stock of fixed capital. And so it's had to run a high investment economy to build its infrastructure, to build its manufacturing capacity. And if you scale the stock of its productive capital by the size of its workforce, what economists call the capital-labor ratios, right, which are key to driving long-term productivity and economic growth, China's still really low. And so, you know, you might, that's caused me to really be cautious in concluding that, you know, the high investment, even high debt economy is another example of the false prosperity. It doesn't mean that China hasn't and can't make mistakes in the future, but I think it's premature to draw that conclusion.
On a relevant point, I think, Stephen, you talk about Washington's long-held penchant for blaming others for problems of its own making. So what do you think are these problems that America is blaming on China?
Well, you know, I when I wrote this, I was looking back at Washington, you know, over the preceding 50 years, Jeremy, and never did I dream that we'd elect the biggest blamer in the history,
right,
of U.S. politics in the face of President Trump, who blames literally everyone, including China. And of course, China was at the top of his list of
scapegoats
during the presidential campaign. Why do we blame others? Is because I think our politicians have a really tough time admitting that there's something fundamentally flawed about our system, that our system gets taken advantage of by others. And again, that's the point that Mr. Trump has made very successfully as a candidate and continually as a president, as he's shredding up one bad deal after another, from TPP to NAFTA to maybe the Korean Free Trade Deal to, I think what I heard this morning, he was shredding up U.S. membership in UNESCO.
That's right.
So there's it's the arrangements and of course the Iran deal, which is very topical today. It's the fact that we've cut unfair deals with others, which has disadvantaged our system and its and our people. That is, it's a very convenient and easy thing for politicians to grasp onto in defending our system as the right appropriate way to conduct our engagement with the rest of the world.
And what, in fact, is the real heart of the matter? What is the, I think you point again and again in your book to shortfall in savings, yes?
Well, I actually think the savings issue is a lightning rod issue for both economies. And I think if I had to write the book again, and every once in a while I get asked to do this, and who knows, I might, I would at least have a chapter or more on just this dichotomy between the world's biggest saver, China, and the world's most deficient saver, the United States. Lacking in saving and wanting to grow in the United States, we must import surplus savings from abroad. It's the only way to square the circle. And when you import surplus savings from abroad, by definition, that gives you a massive deficit in your balance of payments or a current account deficit.
Stephen, could I interrupt? For our non-economist listeners and for me, how do you import savings?
Well, the current account deficit is funded in large part by capital inflows from abroad. Countries like China, Japan, Germany, all of whom run big surpluses, invest heavily in U.S. Treasury security. So foreign ownership of our debt grows at a very sharp rate. China's now the biggest foreign holder of U.S. Treasury securities. It sort of goes back and forth between China and Japan. But, they both hold close to, if you do a full accounting of their holdings, somewhere in the $1.25 to $1.5 trillion each. And that, gets to a final piece in the international connection between the United States and its creditors. When you have this big balance of payments deficit like we do, we count on lots of countries, not just China, not just Japan, not just Germany, to fund us. And the biggest piece of that, again, is split sort of equally between China and Japan. But with every current account deficit, especially in the United States, comes a massive trade deficit with many countries. We don't get those treasury bills for nothing. We have to buy their goods and services to give them the purchasing power to buy those securities. And so last year, 2016, we actually ran trade deficits with 101 countries around the world. And this is, a direct outgrowth of our shortfall of saving in the United States. So whether it's, Republican or Democratic administration and Congress, when they complain about America's trade deficits, and Trump has been the loudest, but the Democrats have complained a lot about it.
Sure.
For decades as well. They don't want to admit that their policies, especially their fiscal policies, which have squeezed our national savings, are really the main reason why we run these trade deficits. So again, it's an example of blaming others for our own inability to formulate effective pro-saving strategies in the U.S. policy engagement.
In the symmetry in your book, China, of course, has its own over-reliance, its own unbalanced character, of course, and that is, you know, over-reliance on exports and perhaps on investment. That's something you're still weighing, but you can put it much better than I do. So describe, if you could, the pathology at the heart of China's dependence on American growth. You know, where was the problem going to come from inevitably?
Well, it goes back to this 20-year period from, say, 1956 to 1976, Great Leap Forward, Cultural Revolution, where Mao's ideological fervor really wreaked havoc on the performance of the Chinese economy. And by his death in 1976, the economy was nearly in shambles.
Sure.
And so there was a very difficult leadership struggle after his death that eventually gave way to Deng Xiaoping, who in December of 1978, in a speech at one of these party
third plenary session of the 11th Party Congress.
Way to go, Kaiser. You have done well on my midterm exam yesterday. he really cleared the air and said, you know, it's time to put sort of this ideological battle behind us in China, and it's important to go forward with a campaign that is more fact-based and introduced this credo of reforms and opening up, which was then translated a few years later into an enormous focus on investment and building what quickly turned into the world's greatest export machine. The quick antidote to China's economic malaise of a near failure of the 20 years before Deng Xiaoping was export-led growth, hooked conveniently onto the demands of voracious income-constrained consumers in the United States. And it worked. The export share of the Chinese economy was about 5% of its GDP in 1979, and it rose sevenfold to 36% in pre-crisis 2007. This was the engine that really drove the 10% growth miracle for nearly 30 years.
How does that compare to the GDP share of exports for countries like Japan, say, in the 1970s, or Germany in the 60s, 70s, and maybe into the 80s?
It's higher, but you know, certainly, you know, in all those economies, you know, they also were relatively historically high export economies. Right. You know, their shares closer, you know, depending upon the economy you pick, somewhere in the low 20% realm. But the big difference for China was the delta going from 5 to 36.
Six. Right.
And that gives you a sense of what reforms and opening up were and why they were so powerful in driving growth. And the particularly sharp inflection of the export share came right in the aftermath of China's WTO accession. Right. In late 2001. China, after over a decade of struggling to get into WTO, was admitted, and I, in the book, write a lot about the role that former Premier Zhu Rongji played in driving that process and the risk he took in going down that road. But the timing turned out to be brilliant because it allowed China to ride a big surge in global trade that occurred right in the aftermath of its WTO accession. And so that was sort of the icing on the cake for the reforms and opening up that drove the export-led growth as originally conceived by Deng Xiaoping.
Do you think that China's been doing more than the United States to correct these imbalances? And if you do, what are the steps that China has been taking to address this problem?
Yeah, that's where the rubber meets the road, Jeremy. You know, if I tell you the answer, though, then, you know, your listeners won't read the book. So, but
they will anyway. We move a lot of units.
I'll dangle a few thoughts there. I think that, you know, the way I write about the story is that this codependency, the pathology of codependency, create a lot of imbalances in both systems, whether they're savings imbalances or imbalances in the structures of their economy. And if you go back a second to sort of the human dimension of psychology, when one of the partners recognizes that, you know, there's a problem and starts to change his behavior and the other one doesn't, then that's a very destabilizing development within this codependent relationship. There's no guarantee that both partners see their problems at the same time and take the same actions to address them, which gets into this asymmetrical adjustment process that you can then take into the economic realm. I do think that China is much more focused on addressing many of its structural imbalances. We can argue about the progress that's been made, but it's an active part of the debate in policy circles and has been so for the last 10 years. The United States is in denial. We don't want to admit that we have problems. We prefer to blame others. And again, maybe I'm going too far with this sort of psychological parallel, but this is a classic manifestation of the scorned partner in a codependent psychological relationship. When one starts to get better and the other one is still stuck in the pathology of depending on the other, then he or she, or in this case, the economy, lashes out at the other one out of frustration, fear, and ultimately anger.
That angry and frustrated partner has a face in my mind and a particular hairstyle.
Who might that be?
Porn silk-like blonde mop atop his head. So how is China actually executing on rebalancing? I mean, it's one thing to talk about growing your services sector. I mean, yeah, in the tertiary portion of GDP contribution passed a few years ago, the primary. And it's... But how is this happening? How does a government decide, okay, we're going to rebalance? What mechanisms does it use to...
Yeah, you don't, you don't take a pill and say, all of a sudden wake up and say, we're different. China's had a sort of a very active discussion of the rebalancing strategy now for 10 years. It started... literally 10 and a half years ago, again, another question on my midterm yesterday, with former Premier Wen Jiabao speaking about a Chinese economy that was unstable, unbalanced, uncoordinated, and ultimately unsustainable. A criticism that came at a time of great strength that we quickly dubbed the Four Uns. And that sparked a big debate over the wisdom of staying the course of this seemingly inflammable, powerful growth model. And, lo and behold, 5 years later, the government enacted this 12th five-year plan that really put some important markers down in the need to reinvent or to rebalance its economic structure from a producer model to more of a consumer model. And, deciphering the sort of the building blocks contained in the 12th five-year plan, my own analysis said that there were three things that they needed to focus on to do it. More jobs, and this was a sort of something that they drew heavily on the development of the job-intensive services sector. Higher real wages, and there the lever was rural-urban migration, with urban workers getting incomes about three times those in the countryside. But the third piece was convincing workers who had more jobs and more wages to spend on discretionary consumption. And that's proved to be more difficult because the missing piece there, by my analysis, is the lack of a solid social safety net, the retirement and healthcare programs that presumably give workers confidence to deal with life cycle aging and health issues. And for a society like China, where the demography has been distorted by the one-child family planning policy, this has proved to be a really difficult aspect of the rebalancing for China. The 13th five-year plan, which is now in effect, attempts to deal more effectively with that. But, I would say right now that China's progress on rebalancing is partial at best. They have made some very important steps in the right direction, but there's still a lot of missing pieces that need to be filled in.
Isn't some of it just a natural result of people having more money? I'm thinking particularly in terms of consumption. I mean, there was an old saying in the 1990s that, you know, Beijingers used to say they could split a one fen coin into two because they knew how to save money so much and they were so good at avoiding spending. Whereas some of the younger Chinese people I know, some of my younger Chinese friends, seem to be as profligate in their spending habits as their American peers.
Yeah, I know. I get the same impression. I have a lot of young Chinese students who I teach now, and I visit them when I go back to China, and you know, they certainly it's hard to distinguish them from their peer groups in this country, and you know, I think there are some generational issues, but ultimately, as an economist, I still break it down into the building blocks of income generation, which come from job creation and real wages, and then the conversion of that labor income into discretionary consumption, which does require you to address these uncertainty issues that are tied back to the lack of a well-funded safety net. So the young millennials seem like they're, you know, spending, you know, in China like our young millennials, but you know, the risk is that you know, they'll wake up one day without any assurance of their life cycle funding needs, and they'll pull back, and that would be an unfortunate stalling out of a consumer-led dynamic, which China would not want to fall into.
There's this expression now, really current, called "kun lao," which is you gnaw on the old people, you eat into your parents' savings. It's a pretty awful phenomenon. I've heard that among urban people in their 20s, actually in China, in first tier cities, there's actually a negative savings rate. I don't know if that's accurate or not. Anyway, you actually cite four, if I can remember correctly, reasons for China's low savings rate. I see that you really think that this lack of a social safety net is really top. Some of the other ones I remember were like financial repression and a very, very high corporate savings rate. And nobody's going to argue with those. What about cultural variables? What about the sort of Confucian, East Asian propensity to save that? I mean, we're going to talk to Kishore Mahbubani in a couple of days. I think maybe it would be one that he might bring up. Do you buy that at all? That there's something in the Confucian culture that predisposes Chinese toward sort of future orientation?
Yes and no. I mean, I think, you know, Jeremy was just hinting at that. I think it's a generational issue. I think certainly the adult, the mature adult population of China that, you know, has gone through, you know, the better part of the last, you know, three or four decades with all of the economic, political, and social uncertainty, and have some understanding of their Confucian heritage, are predisposed toward a more frugal lifestyle. But these young upstarts that I teach and that you encounter, and especially as they're afflicted with the sort of millennial near-term focus that we find in this country, I think you know, this sort of cultural predilection is in the process of changing, and it will change, in my view, if the income trajectory that underpins the economy can be solidified in a way that's consistent with continued strong economic growth that doesn't get into this false prosperity trap that we spoke of earlier, but economic growth that's really underpinned by productivity improvement, which is ultimately a big challenge for all nations in the world.
In terms of the social safety net, how would you evaluate the last few years in terms of the government's efforts? You know, I'm thinking in terms of the healthcare system, particularly the healthcare system has got a long way to go. It is very far from ideal, but there does seem to be a highly focused effort on the government's part to fix it.
Yeah, I like the awareness, but you know, it's sort of classic Chinese. I mean, the emphasis has been on quantity rather than quality. So they, you know, for urban workers, there's near, you know, universal coverage in the healthcare system, but the benefits are just paltry. So it still remains pretty much a cash and pay system. And the same is true of Social Security. For urban workers, the coverage ratios are up to, you know, maybe 60-65%. But the benefits are paltry. So China has sort of got the message that they need to boost their commitment to these safety net programs, but they followed through more in terms of expanding coverage than really deepening the support to these plans through the benefits that ultimately will make a difference.
Stephen, the central event in your book really is, of course, the financial crisis and the Great Recession that followed. Help us to understand how that was perceived from China. I mean, the mainstream media narrative maybe sees China gloating a little bit, worrying about exports falling off, responding really fast with stimulus. But, you know, at a deeper level, how did the leadership understand this crisis? How was the recession seen as a profound threat to China's growth model? And what did it stimulate?
Yeah, well, first of all, I do spend a lot of time talking about the crisis. I don't know if it's really the central event. I don't know if there is one central event, but it clearly, you know, is a wake up call, as I described it in the book, because it really drew this whole structure of the producer model into sharp question, Kaiser. I mean, go back to Wen Jiabao's sort of prescient warning of the four Uns. This was in March of 2007, where he raised this criticism. At the time, the world economy was flying, and there was no real threat to the export miracle. So you sort of wonder, like, you know, what is he talking about? And, you know, a year and a half later, the guy looked like the most, you know, brilliant economic forecaster in the history of forecasting. Producers need support from demand to rationalize the supply. And when the production is aimed at overseas markets, you need that support needs to come from external demand. And so the crisis clobbered the external demand in the biggest consumer of the world, the United States, and left other consumers in a very weakened state. So all of a sudden, the producer model looked completely unsustainable unless the world was going to bounce back immediately in the aftermath of the crisis. There was a lot of hope it might, and you know, the central bankers of the developed world, especially Ben Bernanke, who I spend a chapter talking about and actually drawing some contrast between his approach and Wen Jiabao's approach to economic management, did everything in their power to spark a revival in the United States, and other advanced economies did similar things known as quantitative easing, but it didn't work. And so the developed world remained weak. You know, it was not collapsing as it was during the crisis, but this weakened state of external demand growth for China with its producer model, it had to say, wait a second, this is not a recipe that we can stick with any longer. And so there's a real urgency to rebalance toward more of an internal demand consumption model in the aftermath of a wrenching crisis. So I did emphasize that a lot in the book, and I've emphasized that for years in my discussions with senior Chinese policymakers.
Stephen, you wrote that Americans have been squeezed as workers, but they have benefited as consumers, while the opposite is true for the Chinese. They have benefited as workers, but are squeezed as consumers. The mirror images of codependency could not be sharper. Can you unpack that a little?
Did I write that? Yeah, that's pretty good. Those are...
It's a lovely piece of symmetry.
I mean, the American worker has certainly enjoyed and learned to shop originally Walmart's stocked with goods made in China, increasingly at Amazon, with goods coming from low-cost producers around the world. And so there have been a lot of benefits that have come our way as consumers. But as workers, you know, in an increasingly globalized production platform, our wages continually get put under pressure by these producers in around the world, in these economies like China and other economies in East Asia linked to China through supply chains. And as the world becomes more and more interlinked through these, you know, global supply chains or global value chains, whatever you want to call it, the pressure on high-wage workers in more advanced societies just is unrelenting. And again, this gets right to the heart of a current political debate right now. We have a president who wants to make America great again, which is a, you know, very ambitious and, you know, a worthwhile endeavor to contemplate. But how do we do it? And in a globalized world, without really drawing into question a lot of the rules of engagement that we've become accustomed to, and you know, the symmetry on China is that the strong growth on the production side of the economy has required a focus on high saving to support it, and the high saving has been a very comfortable aspect of China's own investment funding mechanism. And with high saving, very little attention was given to providing support to consumer incomes through, you know, more market interest rates and more of a market-determined currency that might work to the advantage of consumers. So to a large extent, a lot of people, myself included, have concluded that there's been an implicit repression of consumer demand that is sort of the mirror image of China's otherwise very powerful producer model.
Stephen, you have a really interesting chapter about two men who are really critical to the developments of the economies as they do. They are, of course, Zhuangzi, who you've mentioned before, and for whom you have considerable admiration, it's pretty clear, and also Alan Greenspan. And it's interesting that of the two, the communist doesn't come off as the ideologue. In fact, it's Greenspan who comes off as, you know, ideological. Of course, we all know that he was a disciple of Ayn Rand and so forth. Let's talk about these two. You know, Zhuangzi had his own shortcomings, did he not?
Yeah, he was, you know, certainly human like any policymaker, and, you know, gets steeped in his experiences professionally as well as in his case being ostracized for about two decades by the powerful political forces of the this period of great instability China. And Zhuangzi was, you know, he had great instincts, a sort of a industry expert, and worked in the central planning parts of regional, eventually the central government. So he really understood the way in which the small pieces of the Chinese economy came together. But taking his cue from Deng Xiaoping, that, you know, in the late 70s, that, you know, the time for ideology is over, and it's important to be pragmatic and fact-based in addressing economic problems. He was not really making decisions from the standpoint of ideology. The irony is that Alan Greenspan also, you know, as a young economist, you know, he had sort of a similar background in some respects. Maybe I'm stretching it, but, you know, his expertise was sort of in doing industry studies.
He's a micro guy.
Right? He was a micro guy, and he didn't really focus on big picture issues. And so when he became chairman of the Fed in 1987, and, you know, it was maybe 2 months later that the stock market crashed, he had to sort of fly by his coattails in sort of developing a macro strategy to address these big risks that were emerging in the U.S. And so, you know, they both had these micro foundations. And what guided Greenspan's macro view was his sort of laissez-faire, Ayn Rand objectivist ideology. And yet what was missing in Zhuangzi, in part because of his loyalty to the Deng Xiaoping credo, was running Chinese economic policy from an ideological perspective. So it's a really interesting contrast between these two leaders.
You mentioned in your book the American horror of planning, of long-term strategy in the Chinese way. Has this always been the case, or is this a more recent phenomenon?
Well, you know, We certainly have, from time to time, flirted with laying out a broad framework of engaging with our economic or geopolitical challenges. But
the New Deal. And,
yeah, but those are the exceptions. Right. You know, the Marshall Plan.
Sure.
Now we've got, of course, you know, Make America Great Again.
Which is just such a detailed strategy for
not exactly, you know, a sort of a central planning blueprint. But, you know, to us, the bastion of the free market system, central planning, you know, personifies, you know, a failed approach of the Soviet Union and, you know, the ideological connection it has to communism or socialism as being, you know, a state-directed allocation of resources that we find really runs against the grain of everything we stand for as a free market system. We do go through, you know, an annual budgeting process, although the political quagmire in the U.S. is so treacherous that we really can't come to any political agreement on budgets. We do have this sort of exercise in the Joint Economic Committee where we bring together policymakers and talk about issues, but we're reluctant to really embrace these larger strategic initiatives, lest they smack of a too much intervention, and it comes right out of the Soviet style model, and so we shy away from that.
So I see that. I mean, that's part of it. But what about that deep streak of anti-intellectualism, that distrust of experts, that may seem to me to be something, you know, a harvest that we're now reaping. Whereas China, you say, you know, you say China gets it. You say this a couple of times in your book, and I think that in pieces you've written recently, I think you would probably continue to say that China has been pretty enlightened about addressing these fundamental issues in their economy. Is China maybe harvesting the sweeter fruit of decades of essentially technocratic leadership?
That's a tough question. When I first started going to China maybe 20, 25 years ago and engaging in high-level discussions, you know, I had my own expectations of what to expect in terms of, you know, what I had read and studied about this sort of seemingly, you know, oppressive intellectual environment, especially, you know, coming out of the Cultural Revolution. And what shocked me, Kaiser, was the spirit of intellectual engagement that I initially encountered and the willingness to really engage one another and engage policymakers in discussing matters of economic strategy, both retrospectively and prospectively. You know, in my former life as the Wall Street economist, I would have the opportunity to, you know, a couple times a year go in front of the U.S. Congress and testify on matters of strategy, and I was just shocked at the lack of interest, the lack of willingness by a congressman to really engage in matters of substance. Truly a disheartening contrast to me. Does that mean that, you know, they're in a better place than us? No, but it certainly, you know, resonates for an environment in Washington that I think now has become poisonous in its disdain for the insight of experts. I mean, if you're an expert on anything, you're immediately ridiculed as somebody who doesn't have the right to express a point of view.
Whereas Scott Pruitt gets appointed to the head of the EPA.
Talking of, you know, China's tradition of long-term planning, one of the key organizations when looking at China's long-term economic plans is the National Development and Reform Commission, the NDRC, Fa Gaiwei. Can you tell us a little bit about Fa Gaiwei, the NDRC? What are they and what do they do? What should our listeners understand about the power that it wields and the ways that it has shaped Chinese economic strategy?
Yeah, that's something that I would probably add a significant amount to in a revision to the book if I were to rewrite it today. The NDRC, up until the leadership of Xi Jinping, was really the paramount policy apparatus in China. They were responsible for formulating 5-year plans, for approving monetary and fiscal policy initiatives, and down to the detailed project-by-project assessment of major investment projects. They all infrastructure had to go through the NDRC. It was sort of a mini-government within the State Council of China, and it was and still is a group of sort of elite bureaucrats who really, you know, had a wide range of expertise and views on the whole array of economic issues that China faced. Xi Jinping has, I think, come to the conclusion that the NDRC, if anything, is become more a part of the problem than the solution, and has not been nimble enough in recognizing the need to reform the system. And so he has really empowered a broad collection of party
small
committees,
groups, yeah.
The small groups within the party structure, to become more powerful in weighing in on these economic decisions. And it sort of opened up a tension between the government through the NDRC and the party through the leading small committees in these key economic, you know, the jury's out on the implications of that. And it's potentially, to me, could be a worrisome development if it stymies the progress that needs to be taken in this thorny area of reforming the state-owned enterprises. That still is unfinished business in China. And, you know, the party seems more interested in maintaining the primacy of state ownership than more of a market-based solution through the NDRC was seemingly moving toward. And that's an important point of tension that remains.
Yeah, it's really since the end of Ma Kai's tenure, you've seen this sort of what they call, what was it, Guo Jinmin Tui.
Yeah, the state advances, the private sector retweets.
So let's change tack a little bit here and talk about trade, which is, I think, a really one point that you make. I mean, actually, really, it's several points in the book. You know that American politicians, even, you know, economists, certainly the American media, are getting some of these fundamentals about trade just wrong. They're distorting in the way that they size China's exports to the U.S. and giving an inaccurate picture of our actual balance of trade with China. Can you explain what the source of this inaccuracy is and what we are not accurately measuring?
Well, you know, in the world of global value chains, traditional trade statistics have really been rendered extremely inaccurate. And what do I mean by that? Well, I'm looking across the table, and you know, you guys have iPhones or, you know, laptops or pads, and you know, if you take one of those machines apart, and there are people who have actually done this, they'll find that there are components from, you know, multiple production platforms around the world, the intellectual development and capital that went into the design of the product may have been in, to pick a random place, Cupertino, California. But, you know, there was a famous study done by some researchers at the one of the University of California campuses that found like 4 to 5% of a, you know, one of the most widely sold iPhones was actually value added in China.
Right.
And the rest came from, you know, all over the world. In our trade statistics, when an iPhone is shipped from, say, Suzhou or, you know, wherever the last assembly point is in southern China, that product gets tallied as 100% of it being exported from China to the U.S., when in fact only, say, 5%, maybe 10%. Of the value added comes in China. That distorts our trade numbers.
Right, but that idea doesn't seem hard for anyone to wrap their heads around, but why can't
But our official data, Kaiser, don't capture that.
Yeah, well, why can't we change to sort of trade in value added or have some sort of a standard coefficient by which we knock off the value of exports?
Well, there are
You come up with one, right? It's like 44%.
Yeah,
right?
There actually is now a whole global effort that has been spearheaded by the World Trade Organization and the staff of the OECD, which is called trade and value added. And it does correct for these distortions of value chains. And, you know, the U.S.-China trade deficit gets reduced by a large number on any given year, anywhere from 30 to 40% from its measured number as officially reported. And yet, you know, when, you know, the politicians go out on the campaign trail, they give the published number because it's a lot larger. And then they distort it. Our current president used to talk about, you know, $500 billion Chinese deficit, even before, you know, without any correction for value added, the number was never bigger than 350. But you know, he was very creative in rounding statistics.
You talk in your book about the potential of American exports to China, and since the book was published, there's been a lot more about that in the news. Publicity stunts like Jack Ma saying he's going to use Alibaba to empower small to SMEs in America, American entrepreneurs, give them access to the Chinese market. What areas do you see as most promising in terms of U.S. exports to China? What are the American goods and services that really could do well in China?
Well, let's just back up and look at the data, Jeremy. You know, first of all, in my sort of rebalancing prescription of the United States, I want us to move away from excess consumption growth toward more investment and export growth to fill the void. And if I look at exports as a potential for economic renewal, and this is certainly resonates with the strategy of the Trump administration, China is our third largest and by far our most rapidly growing major export market in the world. Our two largest are, you know, Mexico and Canada, but, you know, the Trump administration now wants to tear up the NAFTA accord. And so, you know, the growth potential in those areas gets drawn into serious question. So we should look, you know, in a country like China, which is really focused on growing internal demand, who better to source that internal demand than American producers, and especially true of services. China needs services for economic growth. They have no expertise in a broad array of services, whether it's, you know, retail, hospitality and leisure, healthcare, which is, you know, enormously important to China, even some of the domestic transportation areas. There are services there woefully inadequate. These are great opportunities for us to participate in this potentially explosive growth, which really, I think, underscores what should be the most important issue on the trade agenda for our two economies, access to Chinese markets. And I think we've been misguided by politicians who say, no, the most important thing to do is beat them up on the currency. The currency is not the point right now. The real point is having access to this potentially explosive growth in internal demand and making certain that American producers and services providers have access to this growth in our third largest and most rapidly growing export market, China.
Stephen, you say that trade sanctions on China could be Washington's biggest economic blunder since the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the early 1930s. But your book was written in 2014, and at this point, even with Steve Bannon out and with Peter Navarro now more or less marginalized in the White House, the likelihood of sanctions or other trade issues remains significantly higher than it was under the Obama administration. Tell us what would come of a trade war with China.
Well, I think there were to be significant tariffs placed on all Chinese products that enter the United States, number one, it would be the equivalent of raising the prices of goods sold at Walmart. So it'd be a tax on middle-class consumers. And number two, I think the Chinese would most assuredly retaliate, and so their markets would become less accessible to our companies, and that would underpin or undermine U.S. export growth. And number three, there's every reason to believe that the Chinese would be less eager to buy our treasuries to help us fund our budget deficits, which seem likely to be getting larger rather than smaller under the Trump administration. So it would backfire. The one pause for thought I have here is that, you know, I think it's important that we continue to press China on a number of issues of economic engagement, especially like market access, so that we can participate in the growth, the shift in the growth of their economy. And but I think trade sanctions would really throw a wrench into a more constructive prying open of those markets.
Stephen, tell us about some of the things that you've seen. You were in China just in June, if I remember correctly. What have you seen at street level that, that makes you kind of bullish about China's advance toward rebalancing?
Well, you know, I hesitate to draw great conclusions based on sort of the anecdotes of my own personal experiences. But I do have to say, Kaiser, that, you know, when I was in China a few months ago, and I go there 3, 4, or 5 times a year, but somehow this time the place, the digitization of China seemed to be coming alive right in front of my eyes. Whether it was the bikes, the digitization of retail, the seemingly
the mobile payments,
facile way that young people, especially millennials, use their smartphones for payment.
Right.
There's no cash that seems to really exchange hands anymore. And so I think the digitization of China and the growing role that e-commerce and other internet-related activities play in shaping and reshaping the culture of their large generation of millennials, 44% of the Chinese population, pretty staggering, was pretty obvious to me the last time I was there.
So let's do a little scenario exercise following on that. So each partner in this codependent relationship can either stay on its current unsustainable path, or it can rebalance. And I know it's not simply binary, but for simplicity's sake, let's just say that it is binary, that China rebalances or it doesn't. The U.S. rebalances to a more export-led and investment-led growth model, or it doesn't. So this goes sort of 2x2 matrix with 4 scenarios. Either neither changes, which we know is, you know, the current disaster in waiting, or possibly, or both change, which look pretty unlikely. That's very sunny, of course. The likelihood that the U.S. is going to rebalance while China somehow stops its progress toward rebalancing, this is very, very slim. But there's that one scenario we had already sort of talked about, the asymmetrical one, right? Which maybe is the most likely. Let's say where, you know, China really does make significant progress toward rebalancing, while, I mean, you do give it pretty good marks, while the U.S. sticks to its savings shortfall, consumes well beyond its means, fails to renew infrastructure, fails to retool its industry to take advantage of China as an export market. So what does that scenario look like?
Yeah, just sort of, again, it goes back to my, you know, amateur sort of psychological diagnosis of, you know, two partners sort of confronting the advanced stages of a codependency. Codependency is a reactive disease or pathology. So when, you know, one partner changes, the other reacts strongly to it. So going back to your scenarios, to me, the most likely outcome is the asymmetrical scenario where China makes more progress on the road of rebalancing than the U.S. does. And it goes from, again, to use the lens of saving as the most important measure of rebalancing, it goes from a regime of surplus saving to increasingly a regime of saving absorption, putting its saving to work in funding the safety net of its people rather than subsidizing the safety net of the American people by buying our treasuries and keeping our interest rates low. And what that means is that the U.S. is going to be lacking in a source of open-ended purchases of treasury debt at a time when this current administration seems to leaning toward increasing our debt with large budget deficits over the next several years. And that is potentially a worrisome conclusion for the United States, as its codependent partner seems to be more focused on putting its saving to work at home rather than exporting it to the United States.
Stephen, what is the China gripe? What is the current state of the China gripe?
Well, the China gripe is, you know, I write this book, and you know, then you know, I go on TV shows, or I talk to brilliant, knowledgeable people like yourselves, or give speeches, and everybody's got something negative to say about China. So I said, you know, I can't write a book like this without going through some of the negative critical comments that are made frequently in the West about China, whether it's debt intensive growth, housing bubbles, corruption, unfair trading practices, currency manipulation. So I had a chapter that tried to look at a number of different dimensions of the China gripe to understand, at least to try to be even-handed in understanding the criticism that has been long directed at the West for lots of different reasons. And, you know, I did this because I can smell the coffee of a critical group that on the outside that would find this a book like this unbiased if it didn't really approach these issues. But there was a book that was written now about 20 years ago by a now retired professor from Yale, Jonathan Spence, called The Chan's Great Continent.
That's a great book.
And that book really was a sort of an aha moment for me, because it examined Western perceptions of China over about an 800-year period, starting with Marco Polo and going through Nixon and Kissinger and many, many in between. And the conclusion that Professor Spence reached was really a pretty staggering one, and that is that the West has had a strong predilection in looking at China through the same lens that the West sees itself. So, you know, we go through problems with debt and, you know, asset bubbles, and we conclude that, you know, China's going to go down the same road that we are. And that may be right, or it may not be right, but the biases are something, the anti-China biases are deeply rooted in our history of so-called critical observations of the Chinese system.
The book to read in tandem with that, I think, is also by Jonathan Spence. It's To Change China. I think it would pair very well with The Chan's Great Continent. A quick question here. How do you see the Belt and Road Initiative fitting into China's overall economic strategy? Okay, maybe not a quick question, but I mean, do you see it as a way for China to eventually create new export markets? And is there a danger that in doing so, it's really kind of seeking a way to renew its old habit of export-led growth and dependence on exports?
Well, I hope not. I think that, you know, it's a very sort of ambitious campaign by Xi Jinping to project a larger role for China on the global stage than has been the case in the past. And, you know, a lot of this has been building for quite some time with the objections of China and other developing economies that they are continually being kept on the outside looking in shaping the global institutions that govern the world economic order, whether they're, you know, the United Nations or the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. And there's been a number of objections raised for a long time by China and other leading countries that the global governance needs to be more reflective of the changes that have occurred in the economic global system in the last 30 or 40 years. And China's gone so far as to support new lending institutions, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the New Development Bank, and now the Belt and Road Initiative as a way to indicate that it feels that, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat, that the Western way of pan-regional or global integration is not the only answer. And I don't think China's certainly not walking away from the Bretton Woods institutions, but it also believes that, another approach can exist or coexist side by side.
Supplement them rather than supplant the Bretton Woods institutions, right?
Yeah. But, you know, you raise another question that is...
Are these new export markets?
Is this a way to rationalize excess supply in the old producer model and perpetuate the old producer model? And I hope that's not the case. That would be a setback for China if indeed that were the case. The best work that I've seen, though, suggests that the incremental growth of demand for product, whether it's infrastructure or other types of capacity projects in these Belt and Road economies, is not nearly enough to make a dent in the excess supply that exists in state-owned enterprises. And so the need to cut capacity remains very important, even in the context of this Belt and Road initiative.
Right.
Last question, Stephen. You have a very interesting take on the impact of the internet in the United States and, of course, in China. And it's somewhat at odds with the usual assumptions about the nature of the censored internet in China. Can you talk about what you said in your book about this theme and, you know, whether or not and how it has played out, as you suggested? Because, of course, since the book was published, the crackdown on the internet has actually ratcheted up. You know, the censorship is at, I think all-time highs, meaningless, but it is stricter, as strict as it's ever been.
Well, there are two models of internet control. There's tight control in China, and contrary to what people think, I mean, it's largely self-censored. There is a government censor as well, but most of the content providers are pretty active in censoring material. And then there's the the no control model in the U.S. the bastion of democracy, with the internet being the ultimate manifestation of that democracy. Anything goes, from pornography to political extremism to cyberbullying or interference with our election processes is coming out as we speak. Which model is more sustainable for social aspirations in the long run? I think it's a fascinating and increasingly important question for societies to address around the world. The benefits of the internet in China, I think, are not widely appreciated. China was historically a very fragmented society. So the internet, despite the censorship and self-control, has been a powerful mechanism in integrating the society and the economy and creating a lot of national norms that pre-internet never existed. And you can certainly raise questions about censorship, information censorship, and internet censorship is going too far in limiting the public discourse, and I'm sympathetic to that. In the U.S., though, I think the internet has become an instrument of instability and social, economic, and political polarization that has reached a very dangerous point. And in the current political environment, those risks are becoming more and more apparent. And I'm not just looking at, a president who's got a tweet addiction problem, but I'm looking at, cyberbullying and the interference of Russia in our election process, the Equifax hacking issues, all of which are going at undermining different parts of our society and our socioeconomic structure. And that's a worrisome trend. And I think our free market defense of the internet as being the ultimate instrument of democracy is something that we need to take a long and hard look at before it's too late.
It's interesting that you talk about the internet as a tool of integration nationally. I've pointed this out many times before. Jeremy and I have talked about this on the show, how the internet in China seems weirdly to be sort of more tightly woven, where there's more of a national conversation, where a meme or an idea will sort of spread around nationally, whereas the U.S., maybe the maturity of the internet in the U.S. is making us more fractured and more tribal, as you say. I mean, it's interesting that you can find your own little...
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember when I was doing research for the book and I was looking at some survey data on internet usage and then sort of cable TV and the fragmentation of radio talk shows. And the survey data showed that there was very little cross-fertilization of ideologies, that those on the left would only listen to the messaging that resonated with their own ideological conviction. Right. The same on the right, and there was no crossover. No one was willing to really listen to the other side, and that's the polarization point that has become, I think, more acute in recent years. I mean, I don't know about your Facebook feed, but it's hardly, it's a sure. reflection of your own philosophy through your network of friends, and it's hardly an open architecture of discourse on any issue.
We still find ways to fight. Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. I suggest that for anyone interested in Stephen's ideas, they should check out his writings at projectsyndicate.org. That's project-syndicate.org. And, of course, should read his book, Unbalanced, even though he told you where the rubber meets the road and told you what his conclusions are. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. Before we pack up our little peripatetic studio, let's offer our listeners some recommendations, shall we? But first, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina.com. Sign up for our free daily email newsletter. Download our app. Visit our website. Follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. On Twitter, we are SupChinaNews. And on Facebook, we're at facebook.com/SupChinaNews. If you enjoy the Seneca podcast, go and leave us a positive review on the Apple iTunes Store or on Google Play. Thanks in advance for that. And now, bravely, onward to recommendations. Jeremy, kick us off.
I'd like to recommend a website called thebittersoutherner.com, which is very nice for me as a new Southerner.
And a bitter
one. It's kind of a literary website. It features essays, sometimes fiction, writing about the South from a broad-minded perspective. And it's the kind of thing that I wish some of my Yankee friends would read sometimes before they make disparaging remarks.
Right, okay. All right, very good. Bitter Southerner. I think I've recommended before the Scalawag.
It's another kind of thing.
Southern New Yorker.
Kind of Southern New Yorker kind of thing.
Stephen, what do you have for us?
Well, it would be a book. It's a book that was published last year on globalization by the son of a famous economist, Richard Baldwin. It's called The Great Convergence. Yeah. It's called The Impact of Information Technology on a New Globalization. I have read, I think, almost every major book that's been written on globalization for the last 20 years. I've done a lot of writing myself on the topic. And this one really forced me to rethink a lot of the views I had, because it focuses on the impact of these global supply chains, which we talked about earlier, in changing the way that nations compete. And in Baldwin's view, we're looking at competition the wrong way. We don't compete as nations anymore, but we compete as fragments of a very complex production chain. And we're missing the mark by viewing us versus them.
Trying to draw national borders.
Trying to draw national conclusions and formulate national policy. It's a very easy to read book, and it's a very insightful book.
Great. I'm going to recommend an app called Audm, A-U-D-M. What it is it finds sort of premium, generally sort of longer magazine articles, often from magazines like The Atlantic or New York Magazine or The New Republic. Long reads, as they would call them. And it's an audio app. They have excellent narrators, really skilled narrators who read these pieces. And, there's all the generally the cover stories from The Atlantic are going to be in there. For those of you who just don't have time and, on your commute while riding the train or whatever, don't want to listen to a full audio book or always getting lost, it's just sort of the right bite-sized 45-minute, an hour-long maybe, reads of excellent magazine stories done really quite masterfully. A-U-D-M, Audm. Check it out. I'm quite addicted to it now. Thanks so much again, Stephen. It was great to have you on.
Thank you.
We really enjoy it and look forward to following your work and speaking to you again before too long. Jeremy, man, it's been really good hanging out with you in New York these last couple of days.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn. Drop us an email at Seneca@supchina.com. Visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/supchinanews and follow us on Twitter at supchinanews. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.